The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Thanks to the bravery of our troops, this horrible terrorist leader is no more.
The target, ISIS leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi.
The president ordered the mission near the Turkey-Syria border. The White House confirming al-Qureshi exploded a bomb at the beginning of the raid that killed himself and members of his own family. They add that the mission was complicated because al-Qureshi was running a global terror unit out of the location, with his family living on the upper floor.
Knowing that this terrorist had chosen to surround himself with families, including children, we made a choice to pursue a special forces raid at a much greater risk than to our own people, rather than targeting him with an airstrike.
There were no U.S. casualties, and officials say the mission ran like clockwork.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was one of the first news headlines I heard today. Late last night, American Special Forces units in Syria, they destroyed a safe house where the current leader of ISIS was holding up with his family. And drone strike, I thought, boy, what's going to come from that? You know, what's going to happen? According to the president, as you heard, Hashimi detonated a bomb. He killed himself and the members of his family, including six children and four women, along with three others. Such a waste of life, isn't it? It's so sad to think about that. But the president spoke to the nation this morning, and he said, look, last night's operation took a major terrorist leader off the battlefield. It sent a strong message to terrorists around the world. We will come after you and find you. And, the war on terrorism continues. Meanwhile, over in Russia, tensions continue to mount. The world's an unstable place right now. The U.S. is sending 3,000 troops into Germany and Poland and Romania, all this to help bolster our presence along the western border there. But Russia's troops, I don't know if you've been tracking this at all. I mean, satellite technology shows Russia amassing troop strength along Ukraine's border. It's now reported to be at about 125,000 troops, and that includes 30,000 troops that they just moved into their ally, Belarus, which is, if you're not familiar with it, it's on the northern border of Ukraine. They've also moved, in a type of missile that can carry either, I think, conventional or nuclear warheads. So tensions are mounting. They are rising. And with all this buildup, Vladimir Putin is still accusing the United States and NATO of increasing military tensions and reducing the scope of political decisions, according to Russia's foreign minister. But I sit back, and we'll talk in just a moment. Steve Bucci is going to be stopping by. Dr. Paul Kenger. We'll talk a lot about this hour. And I think it's an important conversation we should have. Vladimir Putin started it. We saw what happened in Crimea, right, as he rolled in there. Now, on the border of Ukraine. Now, Ukraine is not a NATO nation. Does the U.S. have an obligation to defend it? No. Vladimir Putin certainly doesn't want a NATO nation on his border right there. But if he goes into Ukraine, what's to stop him from going into other former Soviet satellite countries? Poland would be in that mix. We could see war in Europe. I pray to God that that's not the case. And with technology today, don't think the U.S. is implacable or immune. I mean, there'll be all sorts of cyber warfare and other things that will take place. Putin is also accusing Ukraine of violating the Minsk agreements. And they were reached, if you're not familiar with that part of history, back in 2014, 2015 to help with the situation in eastern Ukraine. And I heard a Pentagon spokesman say that Russia's continuing to build up forces in the Mediterranean, even the North Atlantic. So our European allies, they're telling Putin, look, you continue like this, there's going to be serious consequences if you make any move against Ukraine. But Putin, he's going to be meeting with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping tomorrow on the sidelines of the Olympics opening ceremony. So two powerful allies. What if they decide to move together? Steve Bucci joins me today. He served America for three decades as an Army Special Force officer, a top Pentagon official. And he's now a visiting fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies, an expert on this. And I've invited him to give us some perspective. And I'm grateful for both your service and your time. Mr. Bucci, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. It's good to be back on the show after a long time. Happy to be here.
I'm delighted to talk with you again, Steve. I love your take. I mean, how significant? Let's start first with this drone strike. I thought it would be a bigger story today. How significant is the death of al-Hashimi? And is there somebody who's going to now replace him as the head of this terrorist group?
Well, first of all, it's very important. Taking out the leadership of ISIS at any point while they are still as active as they are is critical. Does this mean ISIS is gone and dead? No, not at all. There will be someone else who will step up, but how fast they do that, how readily they make that transition, at the very least, we have seriously disrupted whatever they have planned in the short term. And if we're fortunate, maybe there'll be enough infighting in the organization that it will take them at least partially off the playing field for a while as they sort out their leadership. So kudos to President Biden gets to take credit for this. Good call sending in the operators on the ground. That is more risky, but, cleaner from a standpoint than a drone strike.
Yeah.
So this was, I think, a good call. They obviously had the intel that he was there. They took the action. Our guys went in, got him, and got out.
Yep. That's one story. The other story that I've been following, and it really is giving me pause, Steve, I've been praying for peace, for conversion. I hope this all gets disengaged. The situation now between Russia, Ukraine, Europe, the U.S., NATO, let's do this. A little history. The Minsk agreements and how Russia says that, Ukraine is violating them. Is there any merit, any truth to the position that Vladimir Putin has taken? I'd like to look at it not just through my American lens, but, how does Russia see this and why the movements on Ukraine's border? And when Vladimir Putin says that the Ukraine's violated these agreements, maybe give us some historical perspective on what they are and whether there's any merit to it.
Sure. Let's go back a little further than that. When Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, in the minds of ethnic Russians, Ukraine was never a separate country. They saw Ukraine as just a province of Greater Russia, even within the Soviet Union. And when the Soviet Union broke up and Ukraine was given its independence, there were Russians, and Vladimir Putin was one of them, who said, whoa, wait a minute, that they were never independent, like the Baltic countries and some of the other areas in the Kazakhstan, the other stands, they should still be a part of Russia. That was not the way it played out. Ukraine got its freedom. And at that time, they gave up nuclear weapons that this old Soviet empire had stored in Ukrainian territory based on a promise from the United States and the West that if Ukraine was under threat, we would provide the protection. They didn't need to keep those nukes there. We didn't make a treaty with them, but there was an agreement between the countries that we would help them if they were under threat. Fast forward, the Russians came in playing fast and loose, claiming that ethnic Russian citizens in Crimea were under threat. They went in to assist them, and I'm making air quotes here, with their special operators and then later their conventional forces, and essentially annexed the Crimea. Mm-hmm. Then they did the same thing again in eastern Ukraine, the provinces there were heavily ethnically Russian. They didn't like the government in Kiev that was more Western focused. And the Russians came in under exactly the same pretext and then set up an election, a plebiscite, to see supposedly what the will of the people were, and those folks under nobody but Russian control of the election, that they wanted to leave Ukraine and join Russia.
Right.
And they were allowed to do that. The problem is, ever since then, the Russians have continued to support separatists within Ukraine, have continued to fund them, provide them with weapons, and provide people, the so-called little green men, which are Russian special operators wearing uniforms with no insignia, rank, or name tags. And they have been in and out of Ukraine fighting this not quite cold, but not 100% hot war ever since. The Russian claims that Ukraine or the Ukrainians are the ones causing this problem is nonsense. It's laughable, no. And it is completely a pretext. As I think you may have heard, a source from within the Pentagon let out that there was intel of the Russians planning a false flag operation that would be an attack on Russian forces, blaming it on Ukraine, giving them the justification for crossing the border yet again with all those troops that are sitting there to go after Ukraine. Anybody who thinks the Ukrainians are going to deliberately provoke Russia is crazy.
Yeah,
so
right.
That's up to speed there. So long story short, Putin's claims are bogus, and they are transparent to everybody in the world, but that won't stop him potentially from using them as justification for war.
So let's talk about that then. Next steps. He's meeting with Xi Jinping, you know, coming up. I don't know what role China would play in terms of being an ally, and where we'll see Vladimir Putin stop. If he was to go into Ukraine, Russia can clearly take it. What would happen? Would there be war in Europe? Would the U.S. get involved? I mean, how do you see this playing out? I mean, it has potential to get pretty big. I'm hoping it doesn't get to that. If we give Vladimir Putin something, well, then he just extorted the world by putting troops on the border of Ukraine. How do you see this playing out, and how do we get out of it without war?
Well, most experts looked at this as he was doing the buildup on the border leading up to the 100,000-plus troops that are right over there, not even counting the ones that are in Belarus, that what he was doing was setting the conditions so that he could make some demands that he would hope the West would cave into, demands – perhaps for more Ukrainian territory, but not all of it, but a demand such as a promise from NATO that they would never allow Ukraine to join that alliance, and perhaps get NATO to remove some of its troops from other NATO countries that were part of the former Soviet Union, like the Baltics and former Warsaw Pact countries like Poland and Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria. They really believe, Putin does, that those countries should be part of his sphere of influence and should never have been allowed to join NATO and should not permit NATO troops to be stationed there. If he could get those kind of concessions, even if he didn't get another yard of territory,
right.
That would be an enormous win on his part. I don't know if he hoped to get all that, but as much of it as he could, you know, he'd have won this round. To his dismay, the West has actually kind of stood up and are not backing down. Secretary Blinken, who I don't think is the strongest sex state we've ever had, actually said, not no, but heck no, we're not going to do that. You know, if you do take these aggressive steps, you're going to pay a price for it. That is the only way to deal with somebody like Putin. You have to stand up to him. He's just an old-fashioned bully. And if you stand up to him and let him know that the cost will be higher than he is willing to pay, then he'll probably back down.
So let's talk about
the danger. Yeah, Drew, is that he might call your bluff.
Right.
And then you have to back it up. And I hope that the West will back it up. I don't want war any more than anybody else, especially not there in Europe. But if you don't stand up to Putin, he is going to continue to push and continue to demand, and the chance of a bad mistake happening is very high.
Well, the U.S. is talking about sanctions, serious sanctions. You know, would it come to war, or would we just choke him economically?
If we can choke him economically, we will try and do that. And, you know, that's obviously a very strong card. You know, everybody worries about the cyber aspects of it, and they should, because, you know, Putin may decide, well, I'm not going to roll the tanks across the border, but he could unleash the so-called patriotic hackers that he's used in the past, like in Estonia and Georgia, that are supposedly not government actors, but are clearly acting in concert with the policies of the Putin regime. That kind of conflict could get going. But I think Putin also knows we have, not just the United States, but several of our Western allies have a pretty good capability in that regard.
We
would take some hits, too.
That's right.
We could really badly damage his economy, his infrastructure, if we unleashed our own cyber attacks in response. So that's not, you know, just because it's cyber doesn't mean it's less bad. People could still die. People could suffer terribly, particularly in the winter when you start messing with infrastructure. But Putin can push back with those sort of things because, remember, President Biden shut down our natural gas improvements that we had started making under President Trump. And gave Putin the go-ahead with the Nord Stream pipeline.
That.
They control the energy for winter in Western Europe.
And you see why, you know, you see why Germany wants nothing to do with this. You know, I mean, Germany wants nothing to do with this at all. And that pipeline is going to really, I think it's going to make Europe dependent on Russia. There's a lot of variables going on here. My guest, by the way, is Steve Bucci. If you want to join us, I only have him for a few moments. I'll open the phones. You can get in with your question or comment at 888-914-9149. Steve was a top Pentagon official. He was an Army Special Forces officer, and he's got a lot of expertise in this area. And the other variable here, too, and maybe it won't play out. I know that our administration, this current administration, looks incredibly weak. The way we left Afghanistan, a lot of the things that we've done and said recently. And, you know, there's concern. Right now, the Olympics are underway, so China's not making any more moves against Taiwan. But it's very likely China could go into Taiwan if Vladimir Putin goes into Ukraine. Let's talk about those possibilities and ultimately an alliance between these two powers.
Right now, there have not been the indicators that they have a true alliance set up, you know, that they were having meetings and talking about timing and that sort of thing.
Right.
I think the gist of the conversation that Putin and Xi are going to have will be, look, how about at least, you know, don't vote against us, you know, when this comes to the UN Security Council, if something happens, give us some support that way. And you can, even if you're not ready to go to Taiwan right now, what we're doing will set you guys up to give you the precedent you need to go after Taiwan later on. Now, obviously, a worst case scenario is they say, Russia is going to go across the line on this date. You guys, we'll wait a week so you guys can get ready. Then you can go across the line in Taiwan at the same time. That would be a disaster. I'm not saying we would lose, but we would be stretched awfully thin trying to work both Taiwan and Ukraine. Even though I think in Ukraine, we're not going to use ground forces. We'll probably use some air forces and a lot of logistical support, maybe some special operators. Whereas if Taiwan is attacked, that's going to be a major naval engagement. So our forces are going to be split. Our attention would be split. It would be really, really difficult to see this administration not getting wobbly under that kind of pressure. So I hope we don't get to that. But at the very least, I think you'll see some, you know, hopeful from Putin's standpoint, that he'll at least get a nod from Xi not to interfere and not to be adversarial towards him if he does this. But I think we're going to fall somewhere in the middle. Xi may stand back and see what China can gain for leverage from this, from the West, or he may decide, hey, this is an opportunity for us too. We'll at least push some of our agenda so that the West, in hopes to get us off the playing field, will make some concessions to us. But, you know, any way you look at it, Drew, it's a very, very dangerous, difficult situation that's going to require both strength and really steely nerves as we look each other in the eyes and see who blinks first.
Yeah, before I go to the calls, one final question here, just in terms of the international landscape and the chess pieces that are now being moved around the international board. And I don't know the answer to this, and maybe you can explain this to me. I don't know why Russia is sending forces into the Mediterranean and into the North Atlantic right now. I mean, Ukraine is nowhere near those two bodies of water. What's the military or the logistical advantage to doing that? I mean, what's the intention for those, that positioning those forces there?
It gives them some levers to threaten other places in Western Europe. You know, the sea lanes, some of the coastlines, they want to pin down as much of NATO's force structure away from the Ukraine so that they can't get involved in anything that happens there, or at least make the threat of it. You know, they're in the Med, you know, looking at the Dardanelles and that area. If they have their forces there, they may not get involved in the actual engagements with regard to Ukraine, but they can tie up a lot of NATO's southern flank. Out in the North Atlantic, you know, all of the Scandinavian countries, the Baltic countries, are all going to have to look in both directions if something starts to happen. So those movements, they don't need those forces as part of the engagement in Ukraine. So by putting them out there in areas that, you know, at least they have to be watched and monitored by NATO, will cause another set of distractions for the NATO decision makers and the NATO forces.
Yeah, I also heard that, you know, Venezuela has a very strong Russian presence now, too. And that's, you know, it's right down on our south. So we'll see how all this plays out. Steve, thank you for the expertise and the insight. Love to have you back. Hopefully it won't be so long and we can continue to monitor what's happening over over in the east there, in the Eastern Europe, I should say. Thank you for your time. It's always good to talk with you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's Steve Bucci. As I said, served an Army Special Forces officer, a top Pentagon official. He's now a visiting fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies, and he knows what he's talking about. Stay with me. When we come back, I'll take a few phone calls. We'll talk more. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Pope John Paul II is a dagger aimed right at the throat of the Soviet Union.
Other American presidents tried to figure out how to manage the Cold War. Wait, Reagan? Reagan wanted to win the Cold War.
When a government abuses the rights of its own people, it is a grim indication of its willingness to commit violence against others.
The real big battle of the 20th century was between the forces of good versus the forces of evil.
Two boys raised during violent times who would become a president and a pope.
Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's part of the trailer for a great film. It's called The Divine Plan. And it talks about the amazing connection between Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II, a future saint, and how these two men effectively ended the Cold War. There was a quote in that package that just really resonated to me. And it made me think of China and so many of these other nations, a nation that treats its people, its own people, and it disrespects their rights and their freedoms. How's that going to limit them from harming others? You know, so if we see what's happening to the Uyghur people in China, if you can do that to other people, if you can do that to your own people, look at North Korea, look at so many of these other nations, what's to stop them from waging war, nuclear war, any kind of harm against other nations? We need to pray for conversion. I say it all the time. It's the message of Our Lady. It was the message of John Paul. John Paul's message was to be not afraid, right? Be not afraid. He had a special relationship with the Mother of God, and he understood the power and the beauty of the rosary. He prayed the rosary so deeply and so profoundly. He had such a love affair with Our Lady that a future pope, a cardinal from Argentina, a guy by the name of Cardinal Bergoglio, when he saw him praying his rosary, it so profoundly touched him, it inspired him to commit to praying the rosary every day. That was the love that John Paul II had. He witnessed the fall of the Iron Curtain. He took a bullet during that time, but God's hand was on him. And I think we need to call upon him. He's probably the great intercessor of our day, especially for this particular situation that's now brewing, now rising with Russia and Ukraine and the rest of Europe and the world. With Russia now escalating these tensions in Ukraine, we're relying on a president who was on the opposite political side of Ronald Reagan during the Cold War, right, to go into this. And I really hope he makes the right decisions. You know, Biden served in the Senate in 1973, and he saw, he was there. He saw how President Reagan successfully brought an end to the Soviet Union. Senator Biden also saw how Reagan worked through very tense moments with the Soviets, especially when the Soviets shot down. Remember that Korean airline flight 007 over the Sea of Japan? The barbarous act happened because for some reason that 747 flight, 007, inadvertently flew into Soviet territory on its way from Anchorage, Alaska to Seoul, and the Soviets claimed they tried to warn the airplane, but there was no indication that the pilots, saw the warning shots, and a fighter plane shot a missile at it. It went down. There were no survivors. And this could have easily been swept under the rug by the U.S. in order to try to appease the Soviets. But you know what Reagan did? Mm-mm. President Reagan would not hear of it. He would not hear of it. A week after it happened, Reagan issued a memo directing his administration not to let the Soviets off the hook over this. And he wanted to ratchet up the pressure on him. So the Soviets took that as an indication of, quote, U.S. bad intentions. Where do we just hear that, too? Vladimir Putin just used those words, the U.S. had bad intentions. Reagan did not back down. And we know what history would write. He eventually won. I'm joined today by an expert on Ronald Reagan and the Pope, a longtime contributor to this program. I'm very grateful for the time he gives us just about every week here. It's a delight to have with me Dr. Paul Kenger, Executive Director for the Center for Vision and Values, and the author of a book, The Devil and Karl Marx, one of his latest. You should read it. But I would also recommend you read A Pope and a President, a must-read for you. These books belong on your library shelf. Doctor, great to have you back. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hey, Drew. Good to be back. Thanks.
Yeah, an amazing situation we're seeing unfold right now, and I know we can learn a lot from previous leadership and from history. Vladimir Putin, was in the KGB during the time of that crisis we were just talking about, so he saw how President Reagan responded. Now he's president. What's he seeing with President Joe Biden? How does he view this administration? How does he look at Joe Biden?
Well, Ronald Reagan used to understand that the Russians understand weakness, right? They prey on weakness. Mm-hmm. And Reagan had this motto in defense called peace through strength. Yeah. And, there's a Latin phrase, right? Civis para pacem bellum. Do I have that right? If you want peace, prepare for war. Right? Yeah. So I mean, and you know, a lot of our liberal friends don't understand that, right? And this was something that Ronald Reagan in the early 1980s with Bill Clark, who was his closest advisor, very devout Catholic. I got to know Bill very well. He became like a grandfather to me. I was his biographer. Wow. You know, very devout Catholic, and you know, they had to explain to some of the bishops, not all the bishops, but some of the bishops, they had to say, yes, we really are building up the military so we don't have to use it. and there were certain liberal bishops that said, well, that just doesn't make any sense. And there were other bishops that said, yes, it does. Let me try to explain this to you. In fact, I go through in a pope and a president how a cardinal by the name of Joseph Ratzinger called for a meeting with the head of the USCCB and said, I want you to please consider what the Reagan administration is saying to us at the Vatican, right? Is there indeed such a thing as principled deterrence, right? That you build this up so the other side won't attack. Right? Does this not make sense what they're saying here? And then some of these bishops, when several years later on the feast day of the Immaculate Conception, December 8, 1987, Ronald Reagan sat across from Mikhail Gorbachev at the Washington Summit, and they signed the INF Treaty, which to this day is the only treaty in all of history that abolished an entire class of nuclear weapons. And Reagan said, see, this is what I wanted to do. But I had to build the weapons on our side first. Yeah. I had to spend the money before the Soviets would be willing to take down theirs. Yeah. They weren't going to reduce theirs if we didn't have any of ours. So we had to build up in order to build down. And then at that point, some of the doves said, okay, I see. They meant it. Reagan really didn't want to blow up the world like we said that he did. But the point here is peace through strength. And again, Reagan said the Russians understand weakness. And Putin, who was raised in the KGB, Drew, right? He was a lieutenant colonel in the KGB in the 1980s. And he said in a speech about 20 years ago, the collapse of the Soviet Union was the, quote, greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. So you know, he's going to prey on Biden's weakness. In 2014, he went into part of Ukraine, and 8 years later, it looks like he probably wants to bite off more of the Ukraine. It's a very dangerous situation.
So in terms of the current administration, honestly, I think they're showing more spine than I thought they would. I mean, we saw what happened with Afghanistan, a lot of other things. I was wondering about the position or the posturing we would take, and maybe Vladimir Putin thought that we'd be more fickle, maybe offer more concessions. If we had a different leader in the White House, one more along the lines of Ronald Reagan, would Putin be doing what he's doing? Or is Biden and the administration here, you know, are they kind of, I don't know, standing up in the shoes of Reagan and saying, hey, enough's enough. We're not making any concessions.
Yeah, well, interestingly, right now, Putin and also the leader of Ukraine, Zelensky, they both seem to be accusing the Biden administration of hyping going on over there, right? Yeah, like making it sound worse than it is. So at this point, yeah, one might make that argument that the Biden administration seems to be reacting overly aggressively, or at least framing it in an overly aggressive way. But part of the problem here is you have to back up to what happened in Afghanistan, right? Back in late July and August. And it's moments like that send the really dangerous signals, right? So you could then scramble 6 months later to try to make up for that and appear stronger, like you're not going to let something like that happen again. But in the meantime, in the intervening period, the Russians said, oh, look at what we're seeing here in Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. This might be a good time to put up 100,000 troops closer to the Ukrainian border. So credit, right, to the Biden administration for stiffening its spine now.
Yep.
I won't say that now it's too late, but that could have helped to precipitate Russia's actions today. And that's a shame, and it's too bad that it is that way. But in international relations, when you're dealing with bad guys and dictators, and Putin is not a good guy. You know, I often hear this a lot from conservative Catholics, right? On our side, they say, oh, you know, Putin's put the first restrictions on abortion in Russia since, like, Khrushchev. Well, that's true. He has, right? You know, Putin is against same-sex marriage. Well, it's true that he is, right? He is. You know, Putin is the most religious Russian leader since Tsar Nicholas II. Well, true, true. But you know, but he's also, you know, no Democrat, small D Democrat. I mean, your journalists get killed over there. They get poisoned. You know, the guy is kind of a classic Russian strongman, authoritarian dictator who was supposed to be limited to two terms in power when he came in 2000. Well, it's 2022 now. And the guy has made enough changes already to the Russian quote unquote constitution that he's in there until at least 2030. So this is a bad guy on the world stage, and bad guys do bad things.
They do. Let's take a few calls. If you want to join the conversation, 888-914-9149. You can call now. David is listening in Toma, Wisconsin. David, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I think that in this whole situation, I mean, we hear a lot about economic and land and so on and so forth with Russia's actions, but I don't think we can discount, you know, 1,000 years of history that have bound the Russians and Ukrainians together, a history that's actually bound by the Orthodox faith. When Prince Vladimir, you know, over 1,000 years ago, in Kiev, you know, was baptized, and the Slavs really followed him in baptism, thus uniting tribes and peoples not only into a common faith, but also into what we see as Russia today and Ukraine. So I think that we have to, and all of us, really look at the whole religious history of the situation there in Eastern Europe, which is very unique in the world.
David, thank you.
Yeah, he's exactly right, Drew. I mean, this goes back to literally the year 988, right? Not 1988, 988. And you know, I tell the story. I have a piece up right now at the new blog for Tan Books.
Yeah.
So it's called Tan Direction, and I think it's posted on your show page.
Yeah.
And I talk about the case of Vasil Velchkovsky, who was he's a blessed, made so by John Paul II in the early 2000s, and he was persecuted by the communists. August 7, 1945, he was arrested. So he was Ukrainian, Ukrainian Catholic. He was arrested by the Soviets outside of the monastery. They charged him with spreading, quote, anti-Soviet propaganda. And at first, they demanded that he deny his faith, and he refused to do that. And then, Drew, and this gets directly to the caller's point, they demanded that he abandon the Roman Catholic Church and instead join the Russian Orthodox Church. So the communists did that, because at that point under Stalin, the communists had been aggressively infiltrating and seeking to take over the Russian Orthodox Church. I write about this. I have a chapter on this in The Devil and Karl Marx. They tried to turn the Russian Orthodox Church into a competitor, a challenger to Rome. So the communists were trying to do that. And this brave priest, right, a blessed vassal, he said to them, you can shoot and kill me. Go ahead. You can shoot and kill me. So they said, all right, well, you know, we'll do that. They put him in a special KGB cell in Kiev. They drugged him. They beat him. They interrogated him. You know, then they sentenced him to execution by firing squad. And I said, you know what? This would be too good for the priest, right? I don't think we should send him to his God, right? So instead, they just physically and spiritually annihilated the guy till he eventually died in prison June 30th, 1973. He had just turned 70 years old. Guy looked like he was 170 years old. But you know, the larger moral to the story here is that these rivalries go back a long time. Religion has a lot to do with it. And you know, there have been a lot of martyrs to our faith in the Ukraine. A lot of Catholics should know these stories. They're very poignant. They're very sad.
Very sad.
They certainly are. The article, by the way, if you want to read it, Dr. Ken Gore wrote it today, or at least it's posted today. It's called Inspiration from the Ukrainian Martyrs. And we posted it on Twitter. It'll bring you right to the article at Drew Mariani Show. Well worth reading. As I said, we should call upon John Paul II. We should call upon these martyrs who've gone through this very same thing to bring about peace in the situation we're now seeing. I've got to take a short pause. When I come back, if you're on hold, we'll grab your calls. I'm approaching the twilight of today's broadcast, and it would be great to talk with you. The number here, if you want to get in, 888-914-9149. Our conversation with Dr. Paul Kengor continues as we take a look at all that is developing with the Soviet Union, with Russia, Ukraine, and the rest of the world. Stay with me. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Keeping you better informed, educated, and inspired. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That's a classic tune, too. Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for spending a few minutes with me. I hope you can hang out all 3 hours. If you missed any of the conversation, be sure and check out the podcast. You can pick up anything you missed here. We've had a just a wonderful conversation today. Really, all week, we've had some really deep and enlightening conversations. RelevantRadio.com. Go to my show page. You can find them there where podcasts are hosted. And Maggie, of course, will have it up in about an hour. Be sure and check out our Twitter page. You can read Dr. Kengor's article, Inspiration from the Ukrainian Martyrs, and it will inspire you. The page is at Drew Mariani Show. Dr. Kengor joins me today. Two books I always recommend. I think they're great. They sit on my bookshelf, The Devil and Karl Marx, and of course, A Pope and a President. Well, number of the many books that Dr. Kengor has written, and he's with us today as we take a look at learning from our past and applying those principles to the situation that's unfolding with Russia today. And doctor, let's just jump right back into the phones and we can pick it up there. Eugene has a comment for you. Eugene listens in Chicago. Hi, Eugene. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, to put it succinctly, Patton put it right, you know, when he say our enemy is not defeated. And maybe he lost his life because of that. The brotherhood between Russians and Ukrainians has been sustained with a gun to the head of the Ukrainians. I mean, the massacres that were committed by Russians against Ukrainians are incredible. And Putin is using conservative values, allegedly, only to fool the West, particularly American conservatives. I'm totally dismayed to hear some very good people that are fooled, completely fooled by allegedly him being against homosexuals, the LGBT routine, and the abortion. He was in favor of people like Yanukovych in Ukraine, which was incredibly corrupt. I mean, and as I say, I'm very dismayed fundamentally that very good conservative commentators are talking about Putin like if he's a new hero.
Eugene, thank you. Let's pick up on that point. A couple of things that he said there, doctor. But how did this new representation of Vladimir Putin come about? Because as you pointed out, I know Eugene pointed out, I think my previous guest might have as well. I mean, a lot of people look at Vladimir Putin as a man who is Christian, anti-same-sex marriage, anti-a whole lot of these other issues. And, you know, as if though he's not a former KBG or KGB agent and has not done the evils that he's perpetrated. I mean, I don't know how that storyline or that image came to the fore. And how true is it, if at all?
Yeah, he's right. I'm dismayed by it, too. And it's usually liberals and progressives who have been duped by the Russians, right? Because, you know, they'll say, oh, well, you know, the Russians support equal distribution of wealth and helping the workers, and that's good. But in this time, you have conservatives and a lot of conservative Catholics who say, oh, well, Putin's good on same-sex marriage and abortion. Right. Well, okay, but he's not on this other stuff. Right. And you know, the caller made reference to what had happened in the 1930s. It's called Holodomor in the Ukraine. 5 to 10 million people starved to death in the Ukraine through Stalin's forced collectivization of agriculture. And I would implore people listening right now, okay, now think about this. John Paul II, look to John Paul II on this. And he went there, he went to the Ukraine on the 10th anniversary of the Ukraine's independence in 2001. And he referred to the Ukraine as the land drenched with the blood of martyrs, right? The land drenched with the blood of martyrs. And he spoke on the feast day of John the Baptist. He said, look today to John the Baptist, learn from the school of Christ in the footsteps of St. John the Baptist. So he understood that. And I know, and people listening saying, well, look, come on, man, you know, these rivalries go back 1,000 years, 2,000 years. I know they do, but you know, there are people who in Mexico who want to make claims on certain parts of the United States, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, you know, right? Saddam Hussein claimed that Kuwait was like an Iraqi province. Poland and Germany and the Sudetenland and Hitler and World War II and Danzig and all these other – you have these rivalries all the time. But in the modern world where we have rule of law and democracy, you know, you don't just suddenly allow Russia in the year 2022 to go back in and reincorporate parts of the Ukraine into the Russian Empire. It's not the way that we do things. Yeah. So you know, Putin is the bad guy here. He should not be defended on this. And by the way, since you and I commended Biden for getting a little bit of a spine lately on some of this, I got to make this point as an important point of criticism with Biden. Yep. A lot of what's going on right now, too, has to do with energy, gas, natural gas exports. And when Biden stopped producing energy in the United States that Trump had pursued, including gas pipelines and so forth, the Russians are dominating all of that market in Europe. And they've got the Germans eating out of their hands right now on this issue, because they're supplying them with natural gas from pipelines that Ronald Reagan tried to block in the 1980s. So you know, that is totally Biden's fault for screwing up the whole domestic/international energy market to begin with.
Now, explain that to me,
Doctor. People in the White House who understand that stuff.
Explain that to me, though, because I really sit here and I marvel at why we'd shut down the Keystone Pipeline, our own pipelines here, our own energy sources, and we'd give the green light to Russia, who's been aggressive, to complete the pipeline to Germany. Why would the Biden administration do that, other than the fact that he wants us to be, you know, not dependent on fossil fuels and to want to lean more green? I don't know. Why would Biden want to short circuit the U.S. economy and give Putin that type of leverage?
Well, it's one of the things that Donald Trump pointed out all of this, right? Pointed out precisely all of this. And that's one of the things that is so, you know, I'm sorry to use such strong language, but dumb about how liberals think about this kind of stuff. They'll say, well, we shouldn't drill for oil here in the United States. Well, if we don't, somebody else will. And there's a global market for it. It'll come from Saudi Arabia. It'll come from the Middle East. You'll get energy from elsewhere in Europe. You'll get it from the Russians. China will do whatever China can do with coal and everything else. So you know, just because you're not producing it domestically doesn't mean it's going to disappear, right? It's all over the planet. So somebody else is going to step in and do it and provide it. And by the way, you know, it is a natural resource. I mean, the stuff exists in the ground. I'm of the view that God put the stuff there for us to use it. I mean, oil is an amazing thing when you really think about it, right?
it's
how they think about the quote unquote environment and climate change and everything else. So we stop doing it while the other powers of the world increase it, and then it's all still out there anyway. We just end up losing from it,
and not just domestically in economics, but we look on the global stage in foreign policy and international relations as well. It emboldens and empowers other dictators and thugs like Vladimir Putin and also people like Xi in China.
Hey, Doctor, I always love talking with you. I love your passion. I love your perspective. I love your knowledge of history. I only have about a minute left. In terms of what we're now seeing unfold, what do you think Putin will ultimately do? How do we get out of the situation that seems to be boiling up?
Well, it's a good question. And let me say, as somebody that has studied Putin for a long time, I could say what he doesn't want to do. He doesn't want to create the old USSR, right?
No.
He doesn't want Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and even the Baltics and other. But Ukraine is the largest country in Europe outside of Russia itself. And a good question is, how much of it would he like? Would he really want? I don't think we know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. But we've got to be prepared. We've got to be cautious. We've got to be smart about this, and don't do things that invites aggression from Putin. Because like Reagan said, the Russians know and understand and prey on weakness.
Well, Doctor, thank you for being with me. I'm out of time. Of course, people can read you online. We've linked over to you as well, and I look forward to our next conversation. Thanks for making time for us. That's Dr. Paul Kengor. Say a prayer for him and his family and the great work that he does. I'll be back again tomorrow to give you another look at life you won't find anywhere else. Say a prayer for me as well, because you're always in mind. I pray for you every day. Until tomorrow, remember, God loves you, and so do I. Have a great afternoon.